You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hello there, my name's Sue Nelson and I'm joined by my fellow presenters Guy Routledge of The Food Rush. Hi Guy.
Hi Sue, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you. And Ollie Lloyd, who seems to be in a bit of a silly mood today actually. Hi Ollie.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm on a silly mood. You are on a silly mood.
It's just good to be back. I've been away for a few weeks.
You have. And this is the Food Talk Show, obviously. We've got some great guests as usual. So we have Alex Wright and Jack Scott from Dashwater. And Ritam Gandhi, who I know a little bit, from Studio Graphene. Hi, yep. Ritam.
Hey.
I'm going to talk water to start with. But before we talk water, I was just saying to you about water. And you were saying, do you know how tortoises drink water? Is that right? So explain to me about tortoises and water. I know this is a food talk show.
So apparently tortoises are the only animal in the world that drink water or bring water into their body through their behind.
Through their behind? I thought you said from their back.
Through their back. So if you imagine a tortoise has got a head at the front and two little legs, and then the back has got two legs and a little kind of...
See, I would have thought the back was the shell bit.
No, so it comes... So literally, they suck in water basically through their bottom, essentially, yeah.
Right.
What a delightful way to start the show.
So you put your tortoise in a basin of warm water in order to take water.
I wonder if that's how our friends at Dashwater drink their water.
Yes, you're trying to make a link there, just to make sure that people realise. I'm trying to keep it relevant. Today is about water. But just tell me about, so you have a tortoise, because I thought it was illegal to have tortoises.
So
now.
I think it's now illegal to import tortoises.
Right.
But there are a lot of tortoises. We only have one, so Flash, as she's called.
Right.
She. We didn't know she was a she when we called her after Flash Gordon the movie. But Flash roams around our garden, and apparently they move about 1% of their time.
99%, they just sit there.
They just sit taking water into their bottom. Well, that's only when you give them water. They haven't got any other way of getting water.
I should have known that, actually, because my sister has a tortoise called Tank.
Right.
I've barely spoken two words to it, but you know, apparently this is
which roams around the garden.
No, it has a big cage that it sits in. Under, usually, just kind of sits under a warm light. Yeah, pretty useless as a pet.
Do you keep your tortoise?
So Flash walks around the garden,
right? And in the winter,
she lives inside a fridge.
A fridge.
Yeah. So we bought some Black Friday.
Do you have a purpose-built fridge?
We have a drinks fridge that Flash sits in, a sort of like a washing up bowl. She's quite large. She's basically the size of a washing up bowl. I mean, she's big. She's 100 years old, and she sits in the washing up bowl. And there's a little bit of mud that she sort of digs into, and she stays
in
the fridge.
Do you shut the door?
You shut the door and you open it up a bit to keep the air going in. Obviously, they don't drink a lot. Normally, they just hibernate. That's what people used to do, but you shouldn't do that nowadays, apparently.
Oh, okay.
And so she lives in the fridge. We had our first hibernation in the fridge last winter. And so by the 10th of March...
Nobody in your family thinks this is completely bonkers.
Everyone thinks it's completely bonkers. And when people come around, they say, can we see the tortoise? So you take them to the fridge and they open it and there is this enormous tortoise.
This is absurd.
And then you open the fridge door and Flash kind of, you know, moves around. Then you let her roam around.
I think we need some photos for the social media.
We can definitely give her photos, or it didn't happen.
I'll give you a photo.
How do you know that she's 100?
So we went to a hospital which is based just behind King's Cross, or a veterinary hospital, which is where. And the lady there.
Can I ask you how did you take Flash? Did you take her in a bowl, or did you put her in a little carrier bag, Sainsbury's carrier bag,
in a box? And it was part of a sort of moment where we realised that our current hibernation process wasn't working. And it's a long story. Anyway, basically, we took her there, and there's a lovely lady called Nadine, who also has a tortoise that's about the same age, and she specialised in this. And
she specialises in ageing tortoises.
So Flash weighs 3.8 kilos.
Enormous.
It's enormous.
Is your fish like a turtle?
It's a tortoise. No, it doesn't swim. It doesn't swim. It's not one of those large land dogs, you know. I'll show you a picture later. We'll put one for social media.
I think it's a great idea.
We love Flash.
Anyway, the reason why we started talking about Flash is because of the water thing.
I know, sorry.
Yes.
Distractions.
So, there was a link in there somewhere. And I was saying, I don't actually like water, which is really weird for a human being. I don't like drinking water.
Well, I think that's true for a lot of people. It's kind of, you know, this kind of tasteless, boring thing that you just have to have.
Yeah, so I drink loads of tea, and if I have to, I drink sparkling water, which is why we have Alex Wright and Jack Scott here from Dashwater, because maybe, just maybe...
Maybe they're going to change your mind.
They might change my whole life. So I know, Guy, that you know these chaps already.
Yeah, funnily enough, we only actually met face-to-face this morning. We've been in touch with Dash for on and off, I think, since about Christmas. We were organising a Christmas market last year, and we wanted to get these guys to either present or to, you know, let us have some of their delicious drinks. And they said, oh, we're not actually quite ready yet, but keep in touch and we'll see what we can do in the future. Just this week, we're launching a competition with them and a whole bunch of other people from this kind of similar field of creating products with surplus produce or food waste. So you can head over to thefoodrush.com and enter the competition. You can win some delicious Dash and various other things as well.
And the point of Dash Water is that it's water, but it's made with wonky vegetables. Have I got that right?
So luckily, we have two reasons for being. The first is to make water more exciting.
For people like me.
For people like you. Mm. And the second is to use surplus fruit and vegetables that have been rejected by the supermarkets. So that's those are our two missions.
Wonky veg, you know, ugly veg. And fruit and all that sort of stuff. And do you go around to the supermarkets sort of saying, can I have any of your surplus, or are you there before it gets to the supermarket?
Yeah, so our cucumbers come from a farmer in Essex, and they're grade fours and fives. So one and two will go to the supermarket, and we'll take the lower grades to infuse our water with.
So how do you grade a cucumber then? Because it's not straight enough.
Yeah, it's a good question.
One to five on a cucumber.
Some of them are wonky. Some of them are overweight. Some of them have got blemishes on.
Right.
So there's a number of criteria.
Are there only five different grades? Is five the lowest?
Yeah, five's the lowest.
But nothing wrong with it at all. Yeah. But nothing wrong with it at all. It's just not the right shape, but it tastes fine.
Exactly, and we can use it to infuse our water with. Yeah.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, this is a crazy thing about this whole kind of area of like wonky produce. Or there's also kind of a slightly different case as well, where you get surplus as well. Do you guys work with surplus, or is it just the wonky outgraded stuff? Fours and fives.
So we use a bit of both, but the way that we've got sourced our cucumbers, for example, is through the charity Feedback, who have really helped us source them. It's a variation, but using grade four or fives. Mm.
And both of you two were from the drinks sort of food industry anyway, weren't you? So you haven't gone into this blind at all. You've got some great experience. So Alex, tell me your background a little bit before you were mad enough to do this.
So we both come from farming backgrounds and have seen firsthand the high amount of food waste that goes on, about 30% plus. But the fruit and vegetables grown in the UK doesn't end up on consumers' plates. And so we were looking for ways to use surplus ingredients. And at the same time, the old place that we used to work at, we would carry an infusion water bottle that we'd infuse lemon and lime or cucumber and mint, for example, and thought, why can't we get something like this that doesn't have any sugar, calories or sweeteners?
So you were at Causton Press, weren't you?
We were before,
I actually quite like some of their stuff, though. That's
delicious
okay.
flavours. Yeah, yeah, very great. Okay. That rhubarb is delicious.
Yeah. And that's where you got the inspiration. In essence,
yeah, we were both on the sales team there, and as you say, they've had huge success. We started when they just launched their can, so their sort of sparkling can, which was to sort of take on the San Pellegrinos of the world, and we saw that grow enormously.
They're quite good at packaging, aren't they?
The
branding is fantastic. Mm. Yeah, it's really looks great.
Although I have to say, yours is really different from Causton Press. Did you do that deliberately, just thinking, well, we're going on our own, we want it to be really different?
Yeah, I mean, with the packaging, we wanted to stand out on shelf. There's so many different drinks out there, so it was really important that we stood out. So hopefully you'd agree with the dash marks. It's sort of unconventional packaging.
It's the sort of thing that Flash the Tortoise would like, I think. Flash could have a bit of Dash. Instead of just putting a bit of our
horrible
water.
We could race them, Flash versus Dash, and see what happens.
Instead of that horrible water in the bowl that you probably just take out the garden, you could put a little bit of Dash at the bottom of Flash's bowl.
I think Nadine would be giving me strong advice not to do that. Okay. But she does. But Flash does like cucumbers, so I mean, I could understand why she'd like that. Maybe we should try infusing her water with cucumber. Mm.
So should we have a little taste?
So why Dash? Why, tell me about the name.
Yeah, Dash, so it's a dash of flavour, basically.
Okay.
So, But we've also, a lot of people have also said it's a double meaning as well, which we quite like. So everyone's sort of dashing around at the moment with little time. So it's sort of grabbing something on the go that's good for you.
Mm. So I once had an allotment, which I was brought up in inner city London as a kid with no garden. And then all of a sudden, because you reach middle age, you sort of feel like you should do these things.
You feel like you need a garden.
No, so then I sort of got an allotment.
Oh, very nice.
And we asked for allotment from the local council. I thought, oh, it'll be 10 years. That'd be good then, because I'll be retired by then. And I've got one the next week. It's like, oh, God, no, what am I going to do? So it's huge, this thing. It was like 22 yards long. It's massive. Oh, wow. And so I thought, oh, right, well, I better start growing stuff. But I mean, because I've never grown stuff, I didn't quite know what to do. So I'd be planting things. I didn't know it was going downy or uppy sort of stuff.
My knowledge of plants is limited. We're trying to grow some stuff at the moment, and it's just.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm terrible with living things. So anything that is, you know, if it's growing in a pot, I try to have a vegetable patch because I really like the idea of, you know, harvesting from the garden. You bring it in, you cook up something fresh. It's like it always tastes the best.
It's fantastic.
But it always dies before I even get to
harvesting. No, I've got quite good at it.
Ah, we're gonna have to get some tips.
Yeah, courgettes.
Courgettes grow
potatoes,
really well.
Onion, yep. Like things that are really easy, you know, and they're just amazing. It's weird. They grow. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, it's nature, fantastic. Science.
Rhubarb.
So,
rhubarb
works
really well.
As well, yeah. All that. And it does taste fantastic. So I'm going to taste a little bit of this cucumbery. It's sparkly. While I'm doing that, do you want to go through some water facts? Because you're a bit of a boffin when it comes to stats.
You love the fact bit. Mm. So the interesting... I think the whole world of water is quite interesting because there's obviously, you know, if we go back into the 80s, there was sort of the Perriers and the sort of the Evians that kind of emerged on the scene, and people began to drink more and more water. But we're quite interested amongst our audience of foodies, you know, what percentage of people are actually drinking sparkling water and stuff. And actually, what we found is that 35% of people are actually serving tap water at a dinner party.
So actually, put it in a decanter.
As in, like, if you're giving, you know, if you're giving water at a dinner party, you're, you know, they're always serving tap water. So it's an interesting thing, which that is the moment at which you are most likely, apart from when you're on the go, or obviously you drink bottled stuff. Where, so the sort of prestige part of it, and so it's interesting that, you know, so filter water is at 15%, sparkling water is at, you know, about 13%, and still water is at about 15%. So
is that because then when people come to dinner now. You don't just get them drunk, but you actually think, you know, you've got to be... Sorry. That's just my
house. Not been to dinner at my place.
No,
yet,
exactly. So obviously you're going to eat, but you don't want people to get drunk. So what you're saying is, here's some water on the table just to pace yourself. And that's now an acceptable thing to do.
I think it's now expected.
Unexpected,
it's
yeah.
It's expected that you have water on the table at a dinner party.
You never used to, did you?
No, you didn't. No. Right. But it's what you have in the head drink driving, probably.
Yeah.
You know, but now also there's a massive growth of teetotaling amongst the sort of millennial generation.
Absolutely. And
thankfully, I don't know anybody millennial, so that's cool.
I think some of us in here just about qualify, but
really,
but maybe not.
No, but anyway, it's an acceptable thing now.
It is,
but people are doing that with tap water.
But I think there's also like a reaction against filtered water, against bottled water, which is, well, it's not, you know. The miles associated with it, why can't you just filter water? So I think there are two sides of which I think where this stuff comes in is it's really good for on the go,
and
obviously it's
flavour, well.
Different profile. I have to say, the thing for me that's really important about it is that it's grown, so to speak, in the country, or it's produced in the country that we're drinking it. I do have a problem with the food miles associated with bringing water from Fiji from somewhere ridiculous that, you know.
Because let's face it, we're not good at many things, but we're great at rain and water, aren't we?
We are world-class at it.
World-class at rain.
We are world-class at rain.
Is it that all of the fruit and veg, because you have the cucumber-flavoured water and you've got the lemon-flavoured water. The lemons are also grown here as well?
No, the lemons are from Sicily.
Oh, the lemons are from Sicily.
So the lemons are from Sicily, the cucumbers from Essex, and our spring water's from Staffordshire. And it's all infused and canned in Herefordshire.
And the fact that it's canned is also a positive thing sustainably as well, isn't it? Because the, you know, the amount of plastic that we create and throw away, I mean, kind of somewhat shamefully, we're drinking out of plastic water bottles as well.
No, you are.
Or I am, for my sins. But, you know, it preserves the flavour of the water as well, being in the can rather than being in the bottle. Is that right?
Nice. Yeah, it does. So the shelf life is elongated because there's not any light in there. And also it's the most efficient form of recycling packaging that it can.
I do like this lemony one. You can tell the Sicily lemons, actually, because they're very, very nice.
It's really refreshing.
So what's in it? Is it literally just water and the infusion?
So there's spring water, the infusion. We add a bit of citric acid as well to bring down the pH level to maintain shelf life.
Okay, and that's it?
That's it.
And carbonated soap bubbles.
I think that cucumbery one and this one here would be good with a gin.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember we had a session a few weeks back where we tried gin with water. I think it was the Scottish distillery.
Scottish chap.
And we didn't have any tonic around, so we just put it with water. And it was actually really, really good because it was like a fine whiskey that we just watered down a bit.
Like,
but that's what they used to drink. I mean, my grandfather would drink gin and water.
Mm.
It was sort of the World War II kind of, that was the drink.
Mm. Yeah.
Which we've totally
but this would
lost
be
as a drink.
Would be brilliant, you know, especially the cucumber one. I think it would be really, really good.
That would be good with a Hendrix gin, don't you think?
Yeah, they've got a really kind of nice cucumbery note
Can I just congratulate you on managing to brilliantly pivot the world of water into an alcohol conversation?
Okay. Carry on with your research on water then, Ollie. Go on then.
But that's
go on.
That's all I was going to say actually about the world of dinner parties and water.
Oh, that
but I think it's it is interesting that people are looking more and more for brands that are produced here and the products that come from this place. And I think there is just more and more awareness, you know, of the particularly with water. It's a heavy product to transport. That if all that's coming in is the lemons, then that's.
I definitely would go, you know, if I was going out for a sandwich at lunchtime, I'd definitely pick up a can of that. You know, bottled water doesn't do it for me anyway. But and I don't really like, you know, Coke, apart from that lovely Dalston cola we had the other day.
Mm, yeah.
That's definitely a good lunchtime carry.
Yeah, it's funny for me. I normally don't drink sparkling water at all. I find it just tastes like, you can taste that kind of carbonated
mineral.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it just never really sits well with me. But this is just, it's just lightly sparkling and it's very, very refreshing. Mm. It's perfect.
I think you've done a great job on the flavour profile of it. A lot of them taste really unnatural.
Mm.
And
yeah.
This does taste like, you know, when you get water that's been infused with cucumber, which is what it is. It tastes like it is. And often, sadly, along the way in processes, you often lose that authenticity. But I think you guys have done a really great job.
Ritam, you're sitting nice and quietly there. What do you, you've got the cucumber one.
I think it's really interesting. Mm. It's really nice. And one of the things I wasn't sure about when I tried it was whether it was already sparkly or not, or whether it was kind of just plain water. So one of my questions was, how come you decided to make it sparkly? Was there... Did you think about just infusing it? It's just infused water.
Well, yeah, we want to make it a bit more exciting than just plain water. And a lot of people are choosing a Diet Coke, for example, at lunch, which is sparkling.
Yeah.
And gives that 4 p.m. boost as such when you're working during the day. So I think this adds the excitement that you would usually get from your Diet Coke. So the switch over is very easy.
Mm. I guess it also gives it an extra dimension as well, because I mean it's a beautifully simple product, but if it was still water infused with fruit, then that's something that would be very easy to replicate yourself. Mm. You know, just get a jug of water, stick some fruit in it, easy peasy done. Mm-hmm. But the sparkling aspect of it and the way that it's been really delicately balanced means that it's you know, you could do something like this with a, you know, sparkling water and put some fruit in it, but you know it's like it's been given more thought than that, which is great.
Exactly.
Now I know you're in Selfridges and Amazon and Planet Organic and Source Market and all those things. You've both got a sales background, so obviously I think you sort of started off knowing what you were doing and thinking about sales right from the beginning. Social media's been important for you, isn't it, to try and develop your brand?
Yeah, it's something that we've really enjoyed doing. I think social media has become more and more important, and it gives us that tool to get it out to the masses quickly, which other brands didn't used to have. So I think it would be silly not for us not to go big on social. It's great to share with our followers what we're doing, behind the scenes stuff about Alex and I, but also about the provenance of the product and where it comes from, so we can get a really clear message about the product through.
And social media, Twitter in particular?
Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I think Instagram for us at the moment, we're getting the most sort of traction through, even though Twitter is still being great. But
I mean, I know, Ollie, you're with Great British Chefs. You know, you've got a great website, which I quite often go on and get lots of recipes off your website, actually. But Instagram's quite important for you as well, isn't it? Or you believe that Instagram is a real important thing for foodies because they like to look at a little bit of food porny thing going on.
I think different social platforms have different roles. I think if you think about Instagram, I think the way people use Instagram is they're kind of flicking through the accounts they follow, and it's sort of a stream of stuff they're interested in, and they'll click on certain things and go through. So I think the advantage for brands is you kind of get into their conscious of your audience, and you're sort of having stuff flick through. I think with Twitter, it's much more about engaging the influencers. So, you know, we've got about 85,000 followers on Twitter, and it's very much, you know, the top chefs, that, you know, I mean, anyone in the food industry kind of is in our sort of universe. And that's a great way of reaching the top influencers and bloggers. Facebook is just the big platform, I think, for stuff. But I think it's increasingly commercial. And I think the challenge with Facebook for brands is if you do a post, unless you put money behind it, you will not reach anyone. Unless you've got a dog falling out of a tree or a cat falling out of a tree.
or a tortoise
drinking
a
water.
Indeed. So you've been missing a trick there.
I have. It's just not appropriate content for Great British Chefs.
That's the trouble,
isn't it?
Issue. Yeah.
Not unless you've got some tortoise recipes.
Actually, I was quite pleased. We did share an image. We shared a lovely image of a dog collecting Jersey Royal potatoes, and it did really badly on our Facebook page, and we were kind of really pleased that maybe we had an audience that weren't just into pictures of dogs and cats. I said to my social media team, this will do amazingly. They went, yeah, probably will, and did really badly, and we're like, okay, we found the people who like good content.
When you can learn stuff like that from what you're doing, it's brilliant. But yeah, I mean, definitely Facebook and Instagram, because they're both now owned by the same company,
but Facebook doesn't do it for me. There's something,
it's really tough, but
it's a bit like Google.
So many people,
I've sort of gone off them, really. And it's a bit like, you know, Amazon with old Jeff being the most richest
doing everything
person
the
in the world, and he's like, and that sort of slightly puts me off. I prefer the sort of underdog.
You like the
thing.
Underdog, yeah. Interesting.
Don't you? Because it's like a slightly anti-establishment, and they are the establishment now, let's face it, aren't they, really?
Well, he's still irritating Trump quite significantly, which I'll keep supporting him as long as he does that.
You're being political on this show.
I'm always political on this show. I'm pan-American, so I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah. And then other things like awards, just changing the subject here, getting right away from Ollie. Obviously, you've invested in, and it's a lot of time investment, I'm not talking about money, in terms of social media. But also, you've been sort of voted number one as healthy alternative to Diet Coke by Women's Health magazine. And it is just getting yourself all over almost everything, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think for us at the moment, we're trying to get our water in front of the right people in the right place at the right time. So if that means that we become delivery men for the last 6 weeks, which we have become, it's just important to get our drinks out there in front of people.
And should you give away? I mean, it's quite interesting because we come obviously across loads and loads of producers, and some of them, you know, they won't give away and others do as part of their, you know, part of what they do. And when you go to these shows, so Speciality and Fine Food Fair, it's coming up soon, isn't it? You know, loads of people just go there just to trough all day long.
They just walk around with a big bag trying to, you know, fill it up with as many different treats as possible.
We ignore those, you know, people, because they're not buyers, and they're not there for any other reason other than to sort of stuff their face all day. So you know, this thing about giving away, if you're doing something quite new, like you've sort of got to, haven't you? Because how does somebody understand it unless they're, you know...
Yeah, no, definitely. With our sales background, our key focus is to get it on shelf. And then we obviously will sample and give out to people who are able to buy the product. But we're not going to go outside, you know, Oxford Street Tube Station and give out free cans. Right. But we are in sampling in Planet Organic every day, introducing it to the customers.
I guess when you do it that way, where you, I don't know if it's actually you guys who are standing there with the trays, but it gives you an opportunity to get actual feedback from actual potential customers. Whereas if you're like, I walked past Coke, we're handing out cans just outside Oxford Street Tube Station last week, they're probably there every day, and they're just kind of giving them away because they, you know, because they can, but they're not getting any of that feedback. They're just, you know, broadcasting because
it doesn't make sense.
Well, do you know one of the interesting things? I remember when I used to work at Unilever. It's actually more expensive to develop a sample than it is to give away free product.
Right.
So actually, it would be cheaper if one had the budget just to give away cans of this stuff. You had to develop, you know, a half pack size. It would just be way more expensive. For them, you just, you know, the goodwill is huge. Yeah. Like, I mean, I saw Hovis handing out entire loaves the other day. And again, it's just cheaper. Oh, yeah. I say, I, you know, it's amazing. It's cheaper to give out the full loaf than it is to actually give out a slice.
That'd be a bit weird. It would be a bit weird giving somebody a slice of bread.
There's everyone walking around with bags of stuff, and it's clever on some level.
Interesting.
Funny old game,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah, funny old game.
So, who have you guys? So, have you guys all self-funded this, or have you raised money and been out on the crowdfunding platforms? Or what have you done?
So, we're at the concept stage. We pitched the idea to Virgin Startup, and they gave us a bit of cash, but also an amazing mentor, a guy called Ben Keane, who has helped set up about 200 different brands. And with them, they've given us the practical skills to be able to start Dash. And give us all the stuff that you don't learn at university, for example, to be able to create it.
That's so worth its weight in gold, isn't it? Having a great mentor.
And did you have to compete to get that, or how did that work?
To an extent, you have to pitch the idea and go through some quite rigorous process in order to get to the final stage. But yeah, they were super helpful in us launching.
Great.
Brilliant.
Very good. Well, Alex and Jack of Dashwater, we're going to drink some of your fizzy drink in the break, and then we're going to have a chat with Ritam Gandhi of Studio Graphene, which is all like a bit more techie stuff. So we're going to have a little break for a minute, and we'll be back. And we're going to listen to Karen Capetta of Angels and Cookies, and then we'll be back with you later. Thanks.
So I'm Harry and I'm here at the Allergy and Free From show. Only a couple of hours left, but it's still very, very busy. And I'm pretty much right in the centre of it at the moment, and there's plenty of people walking past. And one of the companies that I've just walked past is Angels and Cookies. And they're in a great location. They've got plenty of people walking past. And I've managed to finally grab a chat with Karen, because she's been so busy, who is the founder, is it? The founder of Angels and Cookies. So can you tell me a little bit about the products that you've got here?
Yeah, hi Harry. We have a very versatile product. It's a raw gourmet cookie dough that within 13 to 15 minutes is producing awesome cookies. It's for everyone who suffers from food allergies, from celiacs to, you know, those who suffer from nuts, lactose intolerance, soya intolerance. So it's free of gluten, wheat, dairy, eggs, nuts, and soya. And it's also vegan. We're registered with the Vegan Society. It's a great product in the sense that if you are craving something that is sweet, you don't have to sacrifice your health. And it's made with raw unprocessed cane sugar. So, you know, the sugar content is very, very low as well. And you don't have to feel guilt at the same time. It's a great cookie, not only for people who suffer from food intolerances, but for anyone who's a cookie lover.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we were discussing just before we started the interview about there being 14 allergens that's free.
Yeah, it's free of 14 allergens, yeah.
I guess being at the Allergy and Free From show is absolutely perfect for you guys. How has it been going over the last couple of days?
We sold out yesterday morning of our chocolate fudge and chocolate chip, and people were not happy. They were coming to our stand and they were really annoyed that we'd sold out already. So, you know, we were making fresh batches to the wee hours this morning, and social media said if you want your batch, come now, because, you know, we have a limited number. We've been doing great here, absolutely phenomenal. People are like, where have you been? How come we haven't known about you? We're a small company, so, you know, we're mainly e-commerce. So it's www.angelsandcookies.co.uk, but we're getting more stockists. And we want to keep it small because we want to give people, you know, gluten-free, wheat-free products that are basically unprocessed products.
So whereabouts is it that you are stocked at the moment? Is it all e-commerce? Where is it that you want to go in the future?
Okay, it's mainly e-commerce, so we're mainly online. We're a young company. We have a few stockists, but we're gathering more stockists at the moment. So,
In terms of the allergy show as well, I've looked before we was coming here, and the statistics, like more and more people come here every year, more and more people exhibit here every year as well. Is that a good sign for you in terms of the market? Because obviously it's only going to go one way, you'd think, having looked at the stats of how many people are finding out about intolerances and allergies.
Yeah, no, I think the exposure for us being a small company is fantastic, because a lot of people are like, how come we didn't know about you? How come we didn't, you know, we're on social media, but you know, if you're a major company, it's easy to get that exposure. But when you're small and you make a great product, you know, you're basically reliant on word of mouth and social media and, you know, knocking on doors to let people know what a great product you have to serve the public.
I guess 5-10 years ago, there were people who were struggling with allergies, intolerance, but they didn't really know about it. And even if they did, I suppose there wasn't really the choice in terms of taste.
There was no choice. Oh, we've come a long way. We have come such a long way. I mean, within probably, I would say, within the last 7 to 8 years, it's remarkable what we're doing in terms of gluten-free, wheat-free baking, veganism. I mean, it's just come such a long way that we're making products that, you know, sometimes, you know, are rated above those that are traditional. And it was always my ambition to create, because I've been in alternative baking like since I'm one of the pioneers, it was always my ambition to try to create a baked good that tasted as good as, if not better, than a conventional traditional product. And you know, and that's a challenge for me, but it's also a really fascinating one. And when you reach that point of getting to that level where people are like, you know, really, is that you know, free from, oh gosh, you know, if you, in fact, a lot of times I don't even tell people it's free from, and they don't know until I tell them, because otherwise there's this discrimination or this kind of, oh well, that's got to be bad, or it's got to be you know, really rough texture or unpalatable because it's free from. But we're doing leaps and bounds, man.
Would you say that's the single biggest challenge, actually trying to get that taste spot on so that it texture, you wouldn't know
texture yeah, it's texture. And then when you're not using eggs, it's, wow, I mean, because the eggs are used, you know, to make cakes rise and the leavening, right? And so when you don't have eggs, it's even more challenging for breads and things and baked cookies, cakes and cookies.
In terms of your competition at this stage of your development, would you say that the main competitors are sort of trying to beat people who are trying to do a similar thing in terms of sort of gluten-free, allergy-free sweet goods? Or would you say that you're in competition with like the really big people, like the Maryland cookies and all like the sorts that you see in the supermarkets? Like, where do you find yourself positioning yourself at the moment?
I mean, actually, we have no competition in the sense that there's not another product on the market which is completely 14 allergen-free and vegan, ready-made gourmet cookie dough that in 13 minutes you have your cookies out of the oven like you made them from scratch. No additives, no preservatives or anything. That doesn't mean that once we're not on the market that people are going to start copying us. But, you know, competition is not a problem. I think that really when you're true to yourself and, you know, your customer and your client trusts you. For me, the most important thing is trust and that transparency. And when your client and customer, when they really trust you, there's no competition. So there will always exist competition, you know. And the bigger companies that have the budgets can always try to overcome the smaller ones like myself that don't. But what's going to keep us in the running is the rapport and the ethos that we have with the public, you know. And they're going to come to us because they trust us, you know.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, good luck with it, and hopefully you still don't continue to have competition. Yeah. I think you mentioned it once already, but whereabouts can people find out more? It's via your website?
Oh, yeah, it's www.angelsandcookies.co.uk. We have lots of reviews online, things like that. And if anybody has any questions, we'll be happy to, you know, answer them. And, peace and all good things to everybody. And, yeah, that's it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for chatting to us. Thank you.
And it's us back again. Hi there. And we're joined in the studio by Ritam Gandhi of Studio Graphene. And we've been talking to Alex Wright and Jack Scott of Dashwater. And I've just about finished my sparkly, really rather lovely lemon Dashwater. That's my favourite.
It's really good stuff. Big fan.
Very good. So, Ritam, we sort of know each other a little bit because you won the Food Talk Award, didn't you? When we had our bash at the Oxo Tower, and so we'll talk about, you know, what you won in terms of that, and that's an incredible sort of product called it's Hawk Safety, and it's to do with food safety. I also remember I think we had them on the show, but ages ago.
Yeah, Tom.
Vita Mojo. Yeah. So explain exactly what it is that your company does, Studio Graphene, and then we'll talk about Vita Mojo.
That's always the toughest question to answer. So we're a digital innovation studio. We take ideas and we turn them into digital to reality using digital delivery. And we try and focus on quite a lot of IoT-based ideas, but also just randomly over the last few years, we've sort of almost built a niche for ourselves within the food space, completely not intentional, as with a lot of things that happen in life. I don't have a background in food. And it's just, you know, we did a couple of projects in that space, and I'd like to think we did a good job.
And then you get a reputation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So now actually majority of our work has something to do with food.
Mm. So explain what digital, whatever you called it was.
Digital Innovation
Studio. What does that mean?
So we partner with people to turn something that is, I'd say the best way of putting it is we find new ways of implementing existing technology. Yeah. So we will find opportunities where you can transform something that exists today with using existing technology. So what we will not do is go and invent a new semiconductor chip, or we won't invent some technology that doesn't exist today, but we leverage, we bring things together to essentially take what would be quite a manual analog process and make it much more efficient and make a much more enjoyable experience using technology.
So somebody would come to you and say, I'm doing this already, or I can see my competitors are doing this.
Yeah,
I want to do it as well, but I want to do it better and I want to do it quicker. Help me, partner with me to make this happen.
Absolutely. And a lot of the times an idea also develops. One of the things I've learned is where you have an initial conversation to where you end up are two very different places. Mm-hmm. And that's always the fun of it. And I think what's happened with technology now is, you know, I worked in technology for the last 12 years, but I previously worked more in the kind of corporate side of things. And a project would take 3-4 years to build out. Whereas now there are times where from having a conversation to having something live, it's a month or 2 months away. So it's much quicker, it's much more iterative, and you get a lot, you get that feedback loop, which is quite exciting.
And with prototype, it can be even a matter of days. You know, throw something together, put it in front of somebody just to assess what you know, whether it works or not.
Spot on, exactly.
So tell me the story of Vita Mojo, for example. That's a very good example, isn't it, of the sorts of things that you do. So just explain that from start to finish. That's always quite interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So Vita Mojo is one of our first projects, actually, and it was really good fun. We went through that whole kind of MVP stage. It was really exciting because in a way they were very receptive and very, very, very eager to kind of experiment and learn. And I think in some ways the best approach to have is to almost have a hypothesis or have something that you want to test and accept that you don't have the answers and test it through technology. So I think that, you know, the concept behind Vita Mojo is very much to be a personal chef. You go to a restaurant and you want to alter the menu, or you want to, alter a dish according to your personal dietary needs. So you might say, hey, I really want to have a little bit more kale in my salad, or I want less chicken, or actually, you know what, I want to reverse engineer my meal based on macronutrients. So I want to lose a bit of weight, so I want to reduce the calorie count from 700 calories to 500 calories. Can you reduce ingredients appropriately? And they wanted to test that. And I think, you know, obviously now it's really obvious that that's an absolute success and people love it. And in the beginning, it was very much experimenting and finding out what people wanted. Where, you know, did people really want extreme scenarios? Did they want dishes suggested to them and then tailor them? Did people want it as a takeaway menu, or did people really want to go there and order it?
Yeah. So this is a physical space that they have, isn't it?
It's a physical space.
But you order online.
So it's London's first cashless restaurant. I believe it's London's first cashless restaurant.
So you order what you want online, go and pick it up, or they deliver now, don't they, as well?
No, yeah, so through, I think, Deliveroo and Uber Eats.
Yeah.
So you even if you go to the store, you have to use an iPad Pro and place your order on it. So you don't do it face-to-face.
Yeah.
And the idea is that then it prints in the kitchen the ticket and it'll say that this particular dish has 50 grams of chicken, 100 grams of kale salad, and so on. And actually, funnily enough, and that's the whole thing of bringing technology together, is also a challenge, because obviously kitchen printers in the food space are maybe 20 years old, and the technology that sits behind it is quite archaic. So integrating that with an app was a whole experience.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. So there were a lot of facets to it. You know, think about the fact that in a kitchen, you need that efficiency. You can't have a chef measuring 52 grams of chicken and 26 grams of kale. So it needed to work in kind of loops where they, or scoops that they could use and so on. So there was a lot of thinking that went into it. But the nice thing was that whole journey of going from, is this something people would want? And how would they want that experience to be, and designing it and getting feedback and iterating over the last couple of years has just been fantastic.
And again, what you've done with the Vita Mojo site is that essentially there are some basic there's some basic sort of dishes, if you like, yep. and then you can see how those dishes are broken down, and then you can change the proportion inside those dishes.
Absolutely.
Or take out things or put things in, depending. Mm, exactly. But you've got this sort of menu almost of
exactly.
that. So your client would have come to you and said, that's my sort of idea.
Yeah.
I'm not a digital person.
Exactly.
Help me make that happen.
Exactly.
And again, what you're saying is it wasn't just that. It's like, okay, so how's somebody going to use this? What happens when they arrive? How's that going to work in the kitchen? So from end to end, trying to mm-hmm. think about that whole customer journey, not just the user experience on screen.
Exactly. So it's what people refer to as service design, and how do you tackle a challenge using design principles and using design thinking. And I think that's the fun part, is this whole kind of merge between design and technology. It's, you can't look at things in isolation. So we almost, one of the biggest things we've learned in this is that A, you have to iterate and constantly learn, but you also have to follow a chronology. So a lot of people would turn around and first talk about, oh, hey, I have this idea. What tech should I use to build it? Whereas that's actually, and then they'll find a friend who knows particular technology stack well, and then they'll go after that. Whereas we say, don't think about the technology. Yes, we understand you need to solve this digitally, but actually think about the user experience, think about the service design elements, think about...
So be technology agnostic, you know, don't come with loads and loads of preconceived ideas. I know for my business, what we did is we chunked it up in terms of, you know, this is these are the activities that need to happen, you know, and how do we pass from one thing to the next and whatever. Guy, have you done that with a food rush where you think, okay, well, somebody's come in as a user, how do they then, how does that all work all the way through the system? And
absolutely.
Then who does what bit of that at the back?
We have obviously the website, which is the user-facing part where people can come and they can browse through the content, they can read the recipes, they can, you know, read like fantastic stories about the likes of Dash and enter competitions and stuff like that. But that's just one part of the puzzle. So behind the scenes, we have developed this, you know, entire system, which is mostly leveraging existing technology, just like the guys at Studio Graphene are talking about. So everything that we do is cloud-based because we're an entirely remote team. Mm. So we leverage Google Drive for storing all of the, you know, the things that we're working on. We use an automation tool called Zapier to connect various different things together. So when something happens in one app, it automatically creates the next step in the process.
Yeah.
We've developed a lot of custom tools in the content management system to handle things like generating newsletters automatically from the content that's been published. And we've just tried to take all the things that were available to us, and with my background as a programmer, to piece them all together so that we have something which is repeatable as much as possible.
An end-to-end business.
And an end-to-end business. Mm. And then we use lots of other, you know, various tools, some free, some paid, to manage the team and all the people involved.
Because, Ritam, some people go, well, I want an app, and that's it. That's just not enough, is it? It isn't.
No.
It isn't. That's not a business, really.
No. And I think what's happening now is that space is also becoming crowded. So you have to figure out how you're going to become different.
By saying it's not a business, what I mean is it's not a business just on its own. You've got to have other things around it, is what I mean.
Absolutely. And I think that's actually the fun part. Yeah. I love the blending of kind of using the human element and technology together. I think that's what's fun. And I think a lot of people talk about, you know, the likes of Ubers and Airbnbs, etc., all these platforms, and then they say, actually, they Uber doesn't employ a single driver, Airbnb doesn't currently own any properties, and so on. Amazon, again, is a pass-through of inventory most of the time. And I think that human element needs to be thought through, and the business element around it.
Especially when you're talking about food, because food is, you know, there's people very who have to cook the food, and then there's people who have to order and eat the food. So I think it's wonderful.
Logistics is huge.
How
do you, Ollie, with yours, with BritBritz Chef, because you've got quite an end-to-end business as well with loads of different people.
What I was going to touch on, actually, is I think what's interesting about the technology changes, particularly in the home kitchen, is that people or businesses are starting to make home bits of kit. So it might be a blender, it might be a kettle, actually just too complicated. And I think there's actually beginning to be a consumer backlash about that. I think there is a danger that people are saying, oh, this is Wi-Fi enabled, and this, you know, if you press this button, it makes this recipe. And we're hearing quite a lot of negativity towards certain companies where they've taken their devices, which have always been loved, just too far. And actually, certainly in the chef world, they're starting to reject devices because they are just, you actually can't do what you used to be able to do. You can't use it.
Does that mean they're more likely to go wrong, or just that people are less likely to understand how to use the blooming thing?
Well, it's going to sound really lazy, but, you know, on some level, You know, when you buy a tennis racket, you don't have to read an instruction manual.
Yeah.
And if you're a chef, if you buy, you know, a piece of kit, you know, you should not need to read a 300-page instruction manual.
But men never do, though, do they?
No, of course they don't. But it's interesting. You know, it's where I think, you know, businesses like Apple have been really good, that, you know, when you pick up your
just
laptop,
it's intuitive.
And too often, I think people look to find technology solutions to problems that don't exist. And I think
is that because they just get seduced by the technology, get carried away?
I think because they can, they do. And they think, we need to be really clever to stand out. And so we're going to make this a smart fridge that's got a camera in it that can, you know, recognize all the different ingredients, and it can automatically order it from your favorite, you know, supermarket when you're running low. But then it removes that human element of, well, maybe I didn't want to order anymore.
Do you know, I bought a kitchen timer? You know, you think that would be easy, wouldn't you? But a kitchen timer, I have no clue how to use the
thing. You've got a timer on your phone.
It's got about six different things on, and I've just stuck in the drawer, and I'm really cross with it.
this is the thing.
I'm so cross with it.
No, because you wasted money. And
I'm trying to read the instructions. I still don't understand it. I don't understand. Like, well, can't I just press this button and then it just, you know?
And you just wind up a clock, don't you? And then it goes ping when you've reached.
Yeah, I should have just got an old-fashioned one. That's what I should have done.
Somebody recently sent me a link to an ice cream scoop, a smart ice cream scoop, where at the end of it there's a button which you turn it on. And it takes the heat from your hand to warm up this outer casing of metal so that it seamlessly glides through the ice cream, perfectly creating you a ball.
I can't even be bothered to listen to that, let alone use it.
Well, that's, you know, that's the same every week, isn't it? So,
does it have a long manual?
Like, oh, really?
That's crazy.
But it's interesting because, you know, there's obviously, you know, we were talking to the guys the other day about, you know, apps that tell you where there are food trucks and stuff like that.
Yep.
There are so many good examples where technology is solving genuine consumer problems, but there are as many examples of where technology has just got ahead of itself. Now, on one level, we need that in order to find, you know, where the edge is and where the success is. So, look, you know, it's great that people are innovating and pushing boundaries.
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, your description of sort of the end-to-end user design is what it is all about.
Yeah. Ritam, how do you sort of control yourself? Because people in...
Or clients more.
And clients, yeah.
No, control because yourself in front of clients. When someone's got a stupid idea, you have to kind of hide it.
I'm saying that because you can be seduced by technology, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the consistent way of doing that is logic. So I think it's very hard to... I worked in consulting earlier, and one of the partners I worked under told me one thing in terms of how you manage clients. He said it's very hard to argue with logic, and so I constantly now try because, you know, I'll give you an example. Most founders are very emotive, and they're very excited about the ideas they should be, but the most common mistake across the board that everyone will make is get really excited and from a tech perspective be like, add this. Things that are completely irrelevant and their customers probably don't want. And then they make this big, clunky, complicated product that no one can use. And so that's the most obvious area that people go wrong. And again, the logic behind it is we'll say, just look, you can iterate. It doesn't mean that once you launch a product, it doesn't mean like Dash has got two flavors. It doesn't mean that you can't add 10 flavors after you've launched and you've learned and gotten feedback. And I think that's the logic we try and argue back. And we'll say, all we're saying is have that vision. Amazon started as just a bookstore. They had the vision to be an e-commerce giant.
Yeah, but they're testing it all the time.
And they started, and again, don't get carried away with the tech. In the beginning, Amazon would allow people to order books on their front end, but actually at the back end, it didn't process anything. And then he would physically go and find a book in a bookstore and ship it. And I think then you automate that process and you iterate.
Amazon used to have a thing where if you put in a quantity of -1 or -2, it would actually pay you and then send you however many you've ordered.
Oh, wow.
It
just shows everything has every bit of tech has
and that's the beauty of digital is that you can just you can just push a new release or you can update it and tweak it. I'm always grateful for that. I'm sure Ollie is too. With a digital content platform, you can correct things if there's a typo or if somebody wants to change something.
When you started your business, Ollie, I spent a lot of time looking at processes and mapping end to end how we were going to make it work. Did you do that? Just go for it and then added stuff as you went along? Yours is quite a sophisticated business.
I'm a brand guy. So, the vision for Great British Chefs was always simple, which was to basically build a brand and Great British Chefs and own an audience in terms of foodies. So we're driven by those two mantras. What we can do is very, very broad. We're supported heavily by, a massively high traffic website, and we do a lot of research to pull that data out in order to do stuff around it. But our idea was driven at a very, very top level.
Yeah.
And then we've trickled down. You know, we started in the world of apps. That's not where our future ended up being. Mm. You know, we're debating whether we should create our own food truck at the moment, you know. Mm. So actually we're sort of, you know, we're always playing with, you know, with where's the next frontier. And so in some ways, every time we go into a new world, it's a bit like, okay, how are we going to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. And really thinking through those things rather than just bumbling in, you know, into them, really, really trying
but
to think through.
Yeah, but I think what's exciting is there's so many experts, aren't there? I mean, you know, I think that's what's wonderful about, you know, the sort of the tech world in particular is, you know, and the number of email I get from founders, you know, sort of saying, I've got a crazy idea, can I come and pitch it to you and talk about it? I had a guy on the other day, you know, he was an oil and gas guy, and he reached out and said, I got an idea and I want to tell you about it. And we sat down, we talked for an hour, and hopefully it was useful for him, and off you'll go, talk to another 20 people and you'll get ideas. So I think, you know, people have ideas. I think the key is find, you know, you guys had a real benefit that you were from Causton, which gave you obviously a real understanding of the industry.
Yeah.
But actually there are lots of people who are always prepared to talk and share their advice and knowledge.
And you've got to ask those questions, because most people will give a little bit of their time if you ask in the right way.
Indeed.
People like, you know, sharing their experience and, you know, helping each other out, for the most part. Not always the case, of course, but...
So, Rateem, can I go to Hawk Safety? So this was another one of your projects. We're just talking about Vita Mojo and you know, how you sort of built that for them. Hawk Safety, it won a Food Talk Award because it was really, we thought it was really, really interesting. And basically, it's a food safety and temperature monitoring system. And I know it's now being used by John Lewis, M&S Selfridges. But it's really to do with food waste. That's what we thought. It was a huge contribution to food waste and looking at food waste in a different way. So these lovely guys here are looking at, you know, food that's wasted, and they're looking at products. But you're looking at food waste in a different way there, aren't you?
Yeah, it's so true. And one of the things that I've been trying to explore over the last few months is actually the impact of food waste because of poor logistics in developing countries as well, in places like India, where literally half the food never actually gets from the farm to the end consumer because there are so many intermediaries in the middle, and temperature storage is not really a concept there. And I think what this has kind of taught me is a little bit about food waste is also that food goes bad because of not being kept and controlled at a certain temperature. And there is such a, it's, in some ways it's so simple because you really have to just monitor and control the temperature and make sure it's within a certain range. But it's made complicated by the fact that everyone has devices that are not connected to the internet. So the solution here really is to try and use the whole kind of Internet of Things concept and try and bring that data onto a cloud platform so that people can track it on their phones, get text messages when it's kind of out of range, etc. And really, in some ways, also save energy, because what happens right now is a butcher will... So from a HACCP requirements perspective, they'll have to keep their meats below 5 degrees. But because they aren't really monitoring it real time, they're paranoid. So they'll set their fridges to 2 degrees. And really, there's an energy waste there. Yeah. And then they're paranoid because their fridge breaks down and they discover it and they come back in the morning, all their meat's gone bad. So the idea is to also help conserve a little bit of energy and a little bit of peace of mind.
This Hawk Safety product means that you can, if you have a huge cold storage room, for example, you can take temperature readings from different parts of the storage room because that varies as well. But the most important thing, your bit, is that you can monitor that through an app or your phone or iPad.
Exactly.
And you can see, you might want to check every hour or whatever it is to see exactly what the temperature is where. And that, for me, is using technology to tackle food waste in a very different way.
Yeah, absolutely.
An important way.
I imagine you also don't even need to check it regularly because it can just be configured to send you an alert to say there's something wrong.
Spot on. So it sends you an alert. So if it's outside, you can set a range and then you can say that if it's outside this range, please send me a text message to this number, send me an email, send me a report for the number of times it's been outside this range. Mm. And it's really, I think, one of the things, and this is where I think the technology and the human element comes together, is because you can take that effort away and you can spend that human energy on something else that might actually need where you're currently not spending time and you should be.
Yeah. And we're seeing so many producers, and obviously we've had this lovely Dash Water today, but for my mind, there's too many people starting new products, like in gin and all that sort of stuff, whereas this technological impact on food and food delivery and logistics and is actually a really good market to be in, where there's some real call, there's a real call for people to solve some of these problems.
And also, I mean, you've probably got the number around this, which is something, you know, the food waste in the UK is just a rounding error compared to the food waste in India.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. Just because of the size of the country and the scale of the problem. And that's what's exciting, is if a solution is developed, doesn't matter where it's developed, the application for it
can be used
is anywhere. Global.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is really interesting.
Absolutely.
Are you excited by the what I would call food tech sector? Is that where you're going to put your firmly planting your business?
Absolutely. And well, I'd still say that it's we still work on other we still work in other sectors, but 3 years ago or even 4 years ago, I really didn't understand the sector well. I think now we do, because we've touched on so many different startups in that space, and we're definitely pushing and focusing on that. It's just really fascinating. It's something that everyone has to eat, and the pace at which the sector changes actually is quite exciting and fun. The pace at which new products are coming out, the pace at which people's tastes change, and so on. Someone said that it's a bit similar to fashion. You know, the trends are constantly changing, and it's kind of that keeps people on edge, and it keeps it exciting.
I mean, definitely think so. I think food tech is
absolutely
a really exciting sector.
It's something that we're very very keen on, very interested in. But I think it's also worth mentioning that that we talk primarily to a lot of producers here, and for a lot of them it's this very physical business. It's a physical product. You have to store it, you have to transport it, and all that kind of thing. And whilst they may not be considered food tech products, they can still these food producers can still embrace technology and use it to a huge advantage to get ahead of the competition, which is still largely offline and analog.
Yeah, I totally agree. You never guess what we've run out of time again. I don't know, the hour goes so quickly, doesn't it?
That's unbelievable.
Too quickly.
There's always so much to talk about.
There is always so much to talk about. So I'd just like to say thank you so much to Alex Wright and Jack Scott of Dash Water, particularly like the lemon one.
Thank you.
So, and where can I get that? Because I am going to try and find that.
Just so that's in Selfridges, Planet Organics, Nature Intended, and then online at Amazon.
So I can just get some delivered.
Perfect.
Excellent. And so thank you very much. And Ritam Gandhi, Studio Graphene, I know you're working
thank
on some
you.
Incredible stuff. So definitely worth going onto your website, which is...
Studiographene.com.
Because there's a showcase of some of the best technologies that you're doing.
Absolutely.
And I think the lesson from your perspective is, if you've got a problem that you want to solve, you're really interested in the food sector, you've got your own business, go and work with somebody like you and treat it as a partnership rather than saying, here's my brief.
Yeah,
I want it
absolutely.
Done like this. You know, be
absolutely.
Flexible and come and work with people to try and solve that problem. And it's going to be more successful then, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. You've been listening to The Food Talk Show, which is now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield. California. Did you know that?
I need to get the list, actually, because someone
Coast,
was asking me the
Manchester,
other day.
Manchester, Michigan, Malta, we're everywhere.
Everywhere.
So thank you to my Amazing. Fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Food Rush and Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs, and also to Flash the Tortoise. I want to hear about Flash the Tortoise next
week. The photo
week.
Will be circulating.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
And you could use that probe in the fridge to make
sure.
You
know, I was going
to
say there's a minor opportunity, which is to. I do get very worried about
to
the temperature changes of
exactly,
the fridge if
flash.
I'm away.
Yeah.
We can talk, it's a special
have a chat,
project.
Have a chat okay. with Ritam, he might be able to help you. And if you want to recommend any future guests, anybody doing something groundbreaking in the food sector, please get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow. Or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week, everybody.